I want you to close your eyes for a second. Imagine you're tiny, like microscopically tiny.
Just a single bacterium.
Exactly. You're a bacterium floating in a fluid.
Yeah.
You've got no eyes, no ears, and definitely no brain.
It's a pretty minimalist existence.
It really is. But here's the problem. You are starving. And somewhere in this dark, swirling void, there's food, a distinct pocket of sugar. Your entire existence depends on finding that sugar.
Yeah.
But again, blind, deaf, brainless, how on earth do you find it?
Yeah, that is the fundamental survival question for, you know, the majority of life on Earth.
And the crazy thing is, bacteria like E. coli or Bacillus subtilis, they're actually geniuses at this. They use a process called chemotaxis. They can effectively smell the chemical gradient in the water and navigate straight toward the dinner bell.
Or, to raise the stakes, they smell a toxin, a poison, and swim for their lives in the opposite direction.
Right. And biologically, we kind of know how this works. It's receptors and flagella. But here's the pivot. When you try to describe that messy, wet biological movement with a crisp, clean mathematical equation, it is an absolute nightmare.
Oh, it's total chaos. Because you aren't just modeling one bacterium, you're usually modeling millions of them interacting all at once.
And that is exactly what we are unpacking today. For this deep dive, our mission is to look at a paper that takes a classic 50-year-old mathematical model of this behavior, which was already incredibly difficult, and drags it kicking and screaming into the messy reality of the real world.
It's a heavy hitter of a paper, too. We're looking at the microscopic derivation and well-posedness of the stochastic Keller-Siegel equation. This was published in the Journal of Nonlinear Science in 2021 by Hui Huang and Jinyao Qiu.
Okay, stochastic Keller-Siegel. That sounds like a spell from Harry Potter, or maybe a really intense German techno band.
It does have a certain ring to it. But don't let the math jargon scare you off. At its heart, this is a story about crowds. It's about how we predict the behavior of a swarm, whether that's slime mold, sperm cells, or even human crowds, when the environment around them is just constantly shaking.
So we're going from a perfect textbook mathematical world to a noisy, unpredictable one.
That's the mission. And as we'll see, adding that noise doesn't just make the math harder. It fundamentally changes the answer. It changes how we have to think about biology itself.
Before we break the model, let's establish what the model actually is. You mentioned this is an update to a classic. Who are Keller and Siegel, and why is their equation the gold standard here?
Right. So this is the bedrock of mathematical biology. If you take a graduate course in this field, you are studying the Keller-Siegel equation. It was proposed back in 1970 by Evelyn Keller and Lee Siegel. But here's a fun fact. They weren't looking at E. coli. They were actually studying slime mold.
Slime mold is having a real pop culture moment lately. It solves mazes. It maps subway systems. It's honestly smarter than most people I know.
It is an incredible organism. But Keller and Siegel were interested in a very specific phenomenon. These amoebas are usually solitary, just doing their own thing in the dirt. But when food gets scarce, they suddenly decide to clump together into a single moving slug.
Which is literally a horror movie premise. Like the blob.
Pretty much. To describe this mathematically, Keller and Siegel built an equation based on two warring forces. Think of it like a tug of war. On one side, you have diffusion.
Which is just randomness, right? Entropy. If I drop a splash of milk in my coffee, it diffuses. It spreads out.
Correct. Left alone, bacteria jitters around via Brownian motion and spread out to fill the space. That's force number one. But force number two is aggregation. The bacteria release a chemical signal, like a pheromone, that attracts other bacteria.
So diffusion pushes them apart, and chemotaxis pulls them together.
That is the battle. The Keller-Siegel equation calculates who wins, and this is where the math gets really dramatic. Depending on how many bacteria you have, what we call the initial mass, the result is totally different.
Okay, walk me through the scenarios then. What happens?
Scenario A, you have a low density of bacteria. Diffusion wins. They spread out, the chemical signal is too weak to overcome the randomness, and everyone just kind of drifts around.
Boring. What's scenario B?
Scenario B is where the magic happens. If the mass is above a certain critical threshold, the attraction becomes too strong. The bacteria clump together faster than they can spread out. In the classical model, this leads to something called blow up.
Blow up implies an explosion. Like shrapnel flying everywhere.
Yeah.
But this is the opposite, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an implosion, like a gravitational collapse. The math predicts that in a finite amount of time, the density at a single point becomes infinite.
So they form a microscopic black hole of slime mold.
Mathematically, yes. It becomes a singularity, what we call a Dirac delta function. All the mass concentrates at one single coordinate.
Is there a specific number for this threshold? Like, exactly how much slime mold do I need to break the universe?
In a two-dimensional model, we actually know the exact number. It's 8 pi.
8 pi.
If the mass times the chemotactic sensitivity is greater than 8 pi, boom, blow up. If it's less, they spread out.
That is wild to me. The fate of the entire colony hangs on the number pi. That feels almost mystical.
It's one of the most famous results in the field. But, and here is the twist that Huang and Q introduce in this paper, that classic model has a fatal flaw. It assumes the world is deterministic.
Meaning if I run the simulation of the bacteria today, and then I run it again tomorrow with the exact same starting positions, I get the exact same result.
Exactly. The classic model assumes that while individual bacteria might jitter, what we call idiosyncratic noise, if you have a billion of them, those individual jitters cancel out. Left cancels right. Up cancels down. The crowd as a whole behaves predictably.
It averages out. Like how I can't predict what one single driver will do on the highway, but I can predict that rush hour traffic will be slow.
That's the law of large numbers. But Huang and Q ask a very uncomfortable question. What if the highway itself is moving?
Okay, now we're getting into the new stuff. This is the common noise.
Right. In a real petri dish, or inside a human vein, bacteria aren't swimming in a vacuum. The fluid is swirling. The temperature is fluctuating. Someone bumps the microscope table.
So these are forces that hit everyone at the exact same time.
Yes. And unlike the individual jitter, this common noise does not average out.
Wait, I want to drill down on that. If I have a billion bacteria, shouldn't the sheer number of them just wash out any variation? Why does the external noise win?
Think of it like this. Imagine 1,000 people standing on a giant platform. They're all walking randomly. That's the idiosyncratic noise. If the platform is stationary, they spread out evenly. But now, imagine the platform is on a ship in a storm. The ship tilts left.
Everyone slides left.
It doesn't matter if you have 10 people or 10 million people. If the platform tilts, the entire distribution shifts. You cannot average away the storm.
So the common noise breaks the predictability.
Completely. The authors argue that as the number of particles goes to infinity, you don't get a clean deterministic curve anymore. You get a stochastic partial differential equation, or SPDE. The answer itself becomes random.
So instead of saying, you know, the bacteria will be here, you have to say the bacteria will be somewhere in this probability cloud, depending on how the wind blows.
Precisely. And proving that mathematically, deriving that equation from scratch, that is significantly harder than the old way.
I can imagine. You're trying to build a rule book for a game where the rules change every second.
Yeah.
So how do they do it? The paper talks about starting at the microscopic level.
They build it from the ground up. They start with an interacting particle system. Imagine we're simulating this on a massive supercomputer. We track N individual particles.
Okay, I'm tracking particle number 42. What governs its life?
Three things. First, it has its own random walk. It's jittering. Second, it's being pulled toward the other particles. That's the aggregation, the peer pressure.
And third is the storm.
The common noise. In the math, they represent this with a Wiener process, denoted as W sub T.
Wiener process. I know that sounds like something from a hot dog stand, but I assume in this context it's a bit fancier.
Its standard probabilities speak for random, continuous motion, Brownian motion. But the key is that this W sub T is the exact same for every single particle in the system.
Okay, so we have the jitter, the pull, and the storm. Now, how do they calculate the pull? How does particle A know where particle B is so it can get attracted to it?
This is a crucial piece of the puzzle. They use something called a Bessel potential, denoted as G. Think of it as a scent map. Each bacterium gives off a scent. The Bessel potential is the function that calculates how strong that scent is at any given distance.
So particle 42 checks the Bessel potential, sees the scent is stronger to the left, and moves left.
Right. So we have the setup, we have the particles. Usually, to turn this into a macroscopic solvable equation, you use something called the mean field limit. You let the number of particles go to infinity.
And in the old days, this relied on a concept called propagation of chaos, which, by the way, is the absolute best name for a math theory.
It is pretty metal. Basically, propagation of chaos says that as the crowd gets huge, any two individuals become statistically independent. Since a crowd is so big, my random walk doesn't really affect yours. We become independent entities.
But we just established that with the storm, the common noise, we aren't independent.
Bingo. Because we are both sliding on the same tilting platform, we are linked. The chaos propagates, but it doesn't create true independence. It creates a conditional independence given the noise. The final density isn't a fixed shape. It's a random shape evolving over time.
That sounds incredibly difficult to solve. And looking at the paper, it seems they ran into a major roadblock right in the middle of the derivation. The singularity rears its head again.
This is the villain of the story. Remember the scent map, the Bessel potential?
Yeah.
Well, the classical math has a glitch. If two particles get too close, like if they occupy the exact same coordinate, the force of attraction becomes infinite. You end up dividing by zero.
Physics breaks.
And the model crashes. The paper explicitly says that particle trajectories can visit this singularity, making the system ill-defined. You can't prove a solution exists if your numbers turn into infinity halfway through the simulation.
So how did Huang and Qi fix it? Did they just tell the particles, hey, don't touch?
Essentially, yes. They used a mathematical tool called a mollifier.
A mollifier. It sounds soft, like something you give a teething baby.
It works on the exact same principle, softening the sharp edges. Think of the bacteria not as pinpoint dots, but as bumper cars.
Rubber bumpers.
Right. They wrap the potential in a smoothing function. Imagine a fuzzy ball of radius epsilon. This means the force is spread out over a small area. No matter how close two bacteria get, the force never hits infinity. It hits a maximum, but it stays finite.
Wait, so they cheat? They change the biology to make the math work?
Mathematicians prefer the term regularization. It's a standard trick. You solve the bumper car version first, because that math is safe. Then, once you have that solution, you try to prove that even if you shrink the bumpers down to zero, the answer still holds up.
Okay, so they put bumpers on the bacteria, they have this regularized equation, now they have to actually prove it works.
And this is where the heavy machinery comes in. They needed to prove existence and uniqueness. Does a solution exist? And is it the only valid one?
And I noticed they had to add some fine print here. Conditions apply.
Always. Two big conditions. First, the initial mass has to be small enough. If you start with a crowd that's already incredibly dense, the aggregation force overwhelms the storm and the diffusion way too fast, and the math breaks down.
So no starting with a black hole. Check. What's the second condition?
The second one is really interesting. They require the noise, the diffusion coefficients, to be divergence-free.
Divergence-free. That sounds like fluid dynamics.
It is. It means the fluctuations are incompressible.
Break that down for me.
Imagine the common noise is water swirling in a bathtub. The water moves the bacteria around. It swirls them. But the water itself doesn't compress. It doesn't squash the bacteria together into a point.
I see. So the environment can move the crowd, but the environment itself isn't forcing them into a clump. Only the chemotaxis can do that.
That's the intuition. This keeps the noise from artificially creating a singularity. It keeps the storm fair.
Now, to prove this, I saw they use Grönwall's inequality. I see this name pop up in differential equations all the time. Why is Grönwall the go-to guy here?
Grönwall is essentially the leash. When you're running a simulation, errors tend to grow. You make a tiny rounding error at step one, it gets bigger at step two, and by step 100, your answer is total garbage.
The butterfly effect.
Right. Grönwall's inequality is a mathematical proof that puts a leash on that growth. It proves that the difference between two solutions won't explode exponentially. It allows you to say, if I run this twice, the results will stay close to each other. It proves uniqueness.
And what about duality analysis? They talk about a backward SPDE. This part melted my brain a little bit.
This is the coolest part of the proof, conceptually speaking. To understand the forward flow of the bacteria, they construct a theoretical equation that runs backward in time.
Like the movie Tenet.
A little bit. They use the backward equation to check the forward equation. It acts as a bridge connecting the individual microscopic particle system to the big macroscopic wave. It's a way of validating that the microscopic chaos really does sum up to the macroscopic prediction. It's kind of like checking your math by doing the division in reverse.
So they built the model, they've smoothed out the singularities with bumper cars, and they've used time travel math to prove it's unique. But the final test is, does it actually match reality?
This is the convergence section. This is the payoff.
If I simulate a million particles, does it look like the equation says it should?
It does. They proved the mean field limit. As the number of particles n goes to infinity, and as those bumpers epsilon shrink to zero, the empirical measure of the particle system converges to the solution of the SPDE.
And they didn't just say it matches, they actually gave a number.
They calculated the error rate. They tell you exactly how fast the approximation gets good as n increases. This is crucial because it transforms the paper from a purely theoretical exercise into a usable tool for biologists. You can actually use this to run simulations and know your exact margin of error.
So let's zoom out. We've covered a lot of dense math today. We've got stochastic equations, mollifiers, divergence-free noise. why should you, the listener, care? I mean, it's a great puzzle, but what does this change about how we see the world?
I think it forces us to abandon the idea of clean biology. For decades, we modeled populations like gas in a sealed, perfect box. Predictable. Deterministic.
But real biology is messy.
It's incredibly messy, and this paper says we can handle the mess. We can mathematically model the external noise. This isn't just about bacteria in a dish. Think about neurons migrating in a developing brain. Think about immune cells rushing to a wound.
Sperm cells swimming upstream.
All of these are aggregations happening in fluid environments that are shifting, swirling, and constantly changing. The common noise model is the high-definition version of reality. The old Keller-Siegel model was a cartoon.
It also makes me think about the limits of prediction. We love to think that if we just have enough data, we can predict exactly how a disease will spread or how a tumor will grow.
That's the dream of determinism. Give me the starting positions and I will tell you the future.
But if common noise is built into the system, if the environment prevents the system from ever truly settling,
then we have to accept that we can't predict the specific outcome. We can only predict the probability. We can't say the infection will stop here. We can only say there is a 70% chance the infection stops here, depending on the noise.
We are always just calculating odds in a shaking jar.
That is a very humbling way to put it, but it's likely the truth. And papers like this give us the tools to navigate that uncertainty rather than just pretending it doesn't exist.
Well, on that slightly existential note, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. If common noise prevents a system from ever settling into a deterministic state, what's that imply for how we manage biological outbreaks? Are current predictive models fundamentally overconfident because they ignore the storm? Something to think about.
It really reframes everything.
It does. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the stochastic world of chemotaxis. Keep asking questions, keep challenging the models, and we'll catch you on the next one.